Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lease. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks gotta learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
I'm
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him, and then you felt like you wasn't worthy, and so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room, and I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me, and I said, I want you to do this graph for me, and that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad chap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come. Listen to me. Rich people think differently. So what I'm going to put in your head today is a rich people concept, so you can get to understand it. The only difference between successful people and not is just how they think. Rich people think different. Quit letting people tell you you got to get qualified in another program. You don't need another program to be successful. You need to change the way you think. So here's the deal. The problem with becoming a millionaire is that when you decide that you want to be a millionaire, you immediately start thinking, how can I become a millionaire? Well, that thought don't just pop into your head, so you get frustrated and you don't become a millionaire. And you start creating stuff like, well, I guess this wasn't the Lord's will. Or as soon as I think of how I'm going to make a million. You can't think of how to make $1 million. Stop. Do you know if you knew how to make $1 million? What's the day? Tuesday? Wouldn't you make it by Friday? Would not you make it by Friday? But suppose I told you how you can become a millionaire with what you have. Because here's the deal. All of you have everything it takes to become rich. You just don't believe it. Now, if you can develop this theory that I'm about to share with you, I have the way for you to be rich. This is it. First of all of you have a gift. God gave it to you when he created you. God never created a single soul without giving them a gift. That's the God that created you. He's a very smart God. Here's the cold thing. When he made you, he put the gift inside of you. He didn't hide it under the ocean. It ain't on the mountain nowhere. It ain't under no rocks. You ain't got to go drilling. God
put what you needed inside of you at birth. All of you have a gift. But you have got to do your gift, the thing God gave you at birth to do. It is the thing that you do the absolute best with the least amount of effort. That's your gift. Anything else you're doing, you're wasting your time. Do you hear me? You wasting your time. If when the alarm clock goes off in the morning and it makes you sick every morning that alarm go off, it's because you ain't doing your gift. You're going against what God created you to be. Do most of you know what your gift is? Who in here doesn't know their gift yet? Okay, let me tell you what you do. Go home today. Don't talk to nobody. Sit down and have one conversation with yourself. What is the thing that I do the absolute best with the least amount of effort? This ain't going to take you long. You old enough, you grown. Write it down. I don't care if it's networking. I don't care if it's babysitting. I don't care if it's doing color. I don't care if it's painting. Whatever it is, it's what you do. Sing it. Whatever you do the best, write it down. That's your gift. That's it. You ain't got to go asking a bunch of people. They've been telling you your whole life. You know, you ever have people call you with their problems? They always call you with your problems because you gifted at it. But you didn't know how to identify it. If you identify your gift. Now, let me ask you this question. This thing that you're gifted at, if you did it for somebody, do you think somebody would pay you $10 for your gift? Just $10. Could you babysit for $10? Could you cut somebody's hair for $10? Could you cut their grass for $10? Could you make them a chicken dinner for $10? Could you do something for $10? Everybody, don't you have something somebody would give you $10 for? Okay, now, once you have something that somebody's willing to pay you $10 for, this is how this works. It's called the multiples of 10. See, you don't have to figure out how to be a millionaire. You just got to figure out the thing that makes you $10. So now here we go. You do it and you make $10. Soon as they pay you the 10, go do it 10 more times. Whatever it was. Watch some more kids 10 more times. Get another 10. You got $100. When you get $100, whatever you did to make that $100, listen to me, do it 10 more times. You ain't got to get tricky with it. Just do it 10 more times. You'd have made $1,000. Whatever you did to make the $1,000, don't get smart. Stay stupid now. Do it 10 more times. You have now made $10,000. Hold up. Now we finna grow a little bit, but guess what you got to do to grow? You just got to do some more. Whatever you made $10,000 doing, I need you to do it 10 more times. What you tripping for? If you do it 10 more times, you got $100,000. Now, you might have to hire some people to make this happen. You got to figure that part out. But all you got to do is do what you did for $10. Once you make $100,000, if you just do it 10 more times. I used to spend the night in hotel parking lots. What was I going to do? I ain't had nowhere to stay, so I lived in the car. I had $35, and I said, come on, God, man, I've been trying to make this dream come true. You done left me out here like this. And I was crying so hard that he just said, I didn't like hear a voice or nothing, but he spoke to me, and however he said, if you get up, I'm going to take you places you ain't never been. Now, I was finna quit, so I said, skip it. I'm going to quit anyway. So I got in my car. I went to a payphone. And I was going to call my dad. You remember back in the day where you could punch in a code and call your answering machine and get your messages? So I called, and I punched in the code, and the dude said, doop. He said, hey, Steve, this is Chuck Sutton with Showtime at the Apollo. We saw a tape of you. You're very funny. If you could get here Sunday night, we'd love to put you on television. Call me back. Let me know if you can make it. So I hung the phone up. I'm crushed because my whole dream of being on TV, and I couldn't get to New York. I got $35. How am I going to get to New York? I can't make it. So I'm standing there at the phone booth, and tears just coming down my face. I said, God, so that must be a sign for me to go home. Because this it, I ain't even got the money to go to the Apollo. My whole thing, wanting to be on TV, I couldn't even make the dream come true. This is the most messed up moment. And so I said, man, let me call this dude back and see if he said this Sunday. Because maybe he said next Sunday, and I could hustle up a little bit of money or something. I don't know what I'm going to do, but let me just call him back. So I call him back. Steve, this is Chuck Sutton, Showtime at the Apollo. We saw a tape of yours. You're very, very funny. Look, we have an opening Sunday night at Showtime at the Apollo. If you can make it, we'd love to put you on TV. I said, it's this Sunday. Before I hit the button, I heard, doop, you have another message. Now, it wasn't there before. So I punched my code in. I listened to the second message. It says, Steve Harvey, this is Tom Sober from the Comedy Caravan. This was a Thursday. He said, I have a gig in Jacksonville, Florida on Friday night that pays $150. If you can get there Friday night, you'll make $150. So I called him back and I said, hey, Tom, did you get a gig away? He said, no, it's still available. He said, can you get there? I said, I'm in Pensacola, Florida. I'm 3.5 hours away. So I drive to Jacksonville, Florida, and that night I made the 150. The club owner said, man, you're funnier than the guy we hired. If you stay tomorrow night, I'm going to give you another $150. So now I got $300 now. So I get on the phone. I call Chuck Sutton. I say, hey, man, is the gig still available at Showtime at the Apollo? He said, yeah, we got one opening left. I said, I'll be there. So I called Eastern Airlines, who used to be open back then. They had a special for $99 going from Jacksonville, Florida to New York round trip. So I parked my car at the airport. I got it. Got on a plane, flew. Everything I had was in two bags. Got to the Apollo. I said, hey, man, I'm here. I got there at 11 o'clock in the morning. He said, you can't stay here because you don't come on to the late show tonight. I said, man, I ain't got nowhere to go. I said, if you just let me stay in this building, man, I ain't going to move around nothing. I ain't got nowhere to go. I'm in Harlem. I can't go back out here. I got these two bags. I got victim wrote all over me, man. So he said, all right, if you go upstairs, don't come down. So he put me in the dressing room on the sixth floor. So that's where all the comedians were. So I stayed up there. I got hungry around 3 o'clock. Man, I couldn't take it no more. So I went back downstairs, a dude named Alton Liston. I said, hey, man. He said, man, I thought I told you don't come down them damn steps. I said, hey, man, I'm just hungry, man. I said, let me go to that KFC I saw in the corner. Just let me get some chicken. I'll come right back. He said, man, if you ain't back in 20 minutes, you ain't getting in this building. So I went, bought me some chicken, came back. So the comedians started coming in the building. They started coming up on the sixth floor. So I meet this guy named D.L. Hughley. I introduce myself. He introduced himself. I'm sitting there. Another guy come in named Dwayne Johnson. Then this other dude walked in named Jamie Foxx. And I introduce myself. We don't know each other. Ain't none of us famous. It's 1991, man. They gave everybody the lineup. I was on the last show of the night. I don't go on to 11 at night. I done had this 4 pieces of chicken. I'm starving, man. That chicken done wore off. I'm nervous, man. I'm about to throw up. D.L. Hughley went downstairs. D.L. Hughley got booed off. Dwayne Johnson got booed off. Jamie Foxx went down there and got booed. They booed Jamie. Then Jamie started singing. And then they started clapping. And Jamie had their ass. Then he went back to them jokes. And they got his ass. So I'm walking down the steps and I see Jamie sitting on the steps. I said, hey, man, hang in there. He said, man, that ain't never happened to me before, man. This is crazy. This Jamie Foxx, man, one of the most talented people in all of comedy. And now, you don't even know how nervous I am, man. I can't even. My breathing is shot because these dudes been booed. So I walk out. I had wrote this joke. Mike Tyson had got in a fight in Harlem with this heavyweight named Mitch Green. Mike Tyson had hit the dude in the eye in the store. Now, he was on the news. His eye was swollen. So the joke I wrote was they was interviewing Mitch Green, and he was telling everybody what happened, but his eye took over the interview. And I wrote this joke that his eye started talking and was just, I tell you what happened. The heavyweight champ's fist is coming towards my face. I just said, Lord, Lord, Lord. And I wrote this whole joke about this dude's eyeball talking. And when the punch came, and all this here, the Apollo, man, they went crazy. They lost their mind. I got a standing ovation, man. I walked off stage, man, just started crying. I couldn't believe it. They paid me. I made $750 for being on TV for one night. I had never made $750 telling jokes in one night. And so that was my first television appearance. A couple weeks later, Sinbad was the host of the show. He got this job on a Different World. And so he quit. And so Mark Curry became the host. And then Mark Curry got hanging with Mr. Cooper, and he quit. And they came to me and said, would you come back to New York and host Amateur Night for us to just try you out? Oh, ain't no problem. And so I went to New York. I hosted Amateur Night, and I was killing. But every time we went to commercial break, I was supposed to let the warm-up act take over like Ruben does. But I knew not to let the warm-up act do that because he would change the attitude of the crowd because Apollo was a wild place. So I stayed out there. I did the warm-up and the hosting. And I created a bond with that audience. And that's how I got on TV. It was my very first TV show. I hosted Showtime at Apollo. I ended up being the longest-running host in the history of Showtime. I did that show for 8 years. Nobody ever did it for 8 years. And that was my turn-back moment. See, in your life, everybody has a turn back moment. You have a moment where you can go forward or you can give up. But the thing you have to keep in mind before you give up is that if you give up, the guarantee is it will never happen. That's the guarantee of quitting, that it will never happen, no way under the sun. The only way the possibility remains that it can happen is if you never give up no matter what. Because God is always coming. He's never too late. At your worst moment, look, man, when they told me I had to be in New York, I saw no way I could get there. But that God, though, he make the phone ring. I end up in Florida, I make $300. Then I go to New York, I make $750. Almost got $1,000 out of nowhere. That's what happened to me. That was my moment of never giving up. That's when I first learned that faith was everything, that you have to remain faithful.
Because I used to observe that a lot of those shacks used to be by the track, where black people were.
With the room in the back.
Yes, with the room in the back. That was a safety net.
Yeah.
Where black people who would move here and there and go from here and there looking for jobs, that's usually why we move, and the jobs would play out like they always did.
And do. And,
but we had a place to go when the sun went down. But now, those shacks by the track don't exist anymore. They came and built highways right alongside of those railroad tracks where those shacks used to be. Super highways. So now, if you get on a highway, you might notice that if you, sometimes you are right alongside of a railroad track. You see trains passing
that
as you are driving.
That is true.
Down a super highway.
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, those highways used not to be there. in the northwestern hemisphere. It used to be shacks along there. A lot of those shacks were on what we call railroad property. But the railroad people, the people that ran the railroads, didn't care much because nobody wanted to be down. That wasn't prime real estate.
No.
Nobody wanted to be by the tracks anyway. So black people used to build those shacks around there back when black people knew how to build shacks. Black people don't know how to build anything now because they used to build places for white people, but they cut them off with things called unions, took them out, took the carpentry all out of the schools and all like that. So how many black people do you know that know how to fix anything now? It used to be thousands and millions of black people that know how to build a house from scratch out of old pieces of lumber.
Wow.
A lot of people don't remember that. Most people are not that old to have seen it done. I'm old enough to remember when many black people used to get together on a Saturday afternoon. That was the only time they had off, or sometimes, or on a Sunday sometimes after church. They would get together, six or eight of them, and go down and build what they call a shotgun house. It wasn't much, but it was a roof over your head, a good solid roof. I've been in some of those houses, raised up in some. All right? They were excellent, solid houses. They could stand a lot of storm and rain. They weren't much, just maybe three rooms. But I've been in some of them. And there were many, 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 many of them. But along came the white supremacists and say, these Negroes know how to build stuff. We're going to fix that so the next generation won't know how to do anything except stand in front of a place that is built and big, because they won't know anything about carpentry or masonry or how to make anything with them.
All right. I got a busy week this week. We want to talk about Annie Malone, but before we get to Annie Malone, and we'll probably cover her more in detail tomorrow, I'm just dropping a little seed out there today. Today's podcast is titled Paradigm Shift in Daily Routine. On the Blog Talk Radio scrolling marquee, you can see what I have a copy of there, or if you go to our Facebook page, It's My House TV. Go to our Facebook page, It's My House TV, at Off-Grid Housing University. It's My House TV at Off-Grid Housing University. That's our Facebook page. Look for Daily Routine there. And it's like mid-year right now. Some of you might, I know I do, did. And I'm going through a paradigm shift right now. But we want to include that along with and we've mentioned Annie Malone on here before, but I want to go into more detail to prepare for that. I need to prepare for it today so I can present it correctly tomorrow. Then we'll be able to talk calls and comments too. But in any event, check out the scrolling marquee on our Blog Talk show for today. All right. Let me see. All right. Anyway, we got a couple more clips to play, and then we're going to close out early because, like, I got a real busy week this week, part of which is I'm building solo. So, and I'm part of my daily routine is to take 2 to 4 hours out of my day every day to build something. So, or at least start on something. In any event, we'll play a couple more clips and then we're going to end it for the day. But tomorrow, Annie Malone.
Today we have organizations like the SBA making it easier for you to get into business. But 50 years ago, what do you think the odds would be that you could start your own small business and make it succeed?
The odds were against a black man succeeding in the business world, but John Johnson has never been one to look at the downside. He used $500, perseverance, faith, and family devotion to build an empire worth nearly $200 million. His name is now a legend in the world of publishing, fashion, beauty products, and broadcasting. John Johnson has a formula for taking what seems impossible and making it real. His story is an inspiration for people of all colors.
Well, I guess it just proves in a continuing way that there is opportunity there. That given the knowledge, the devotion, and the sacrifice, that success can come. So it ought to tell us that more young blacks ought to take a chance. I think really that in the past, when young blacks have gone to college, we have assumed that we did not get respect and prestige unless we went into the professions. I think now more and more that is changing. We're recognizing that money and success gives you prestige and recognition, even though it may come from selling hamburgers, it may come from selling barbecue, it may come from opening a grocery store or running a cleaning plant or any other thing. And I think as we move ahead and as those areas, the business area, gets more recognition and more credibility, then I think more young people will go into it. Unfortunately, in the white corporate world as we know it today, there is a ceiling on how far blacks can go. There are rare exceptions, but by and large, the vice presidency is as far as you can go. Now, there are some of us who are not just temperamentally suited to be only vice president. We want to be presidents. We want to run things. We want to be in charge. For those people, I say, you've got to go out and start your own. And so I believe for people who are satisfied to be a vice president, perhaps in the long run, for people who want to work for someone else and to live under the fear now of mergers and buyouts, all of which jeopardize their security, if they want to live that way, fine. But if they really want to have a degree of security, a degree of fulfillment, if they want to make a contribution to the race as a whole, then I think they need to go out and start their own.
If you had to do it all over again today, what type of business would you go into?
If I was starting over again today, and if all the publications were in place that are in place today, I don't think I'd go into the publishing business. I think I'd be inclined to go into the service business, somewhere where you're rendering service. I might want to start my own chain of hamburger places. I still think it's very sad that we don't have barbecue franchises. I think we could develop cleaning establishment franchises. I think anything that would give service to the public would be a good thing to go into now. Because service is no longer important to people. You walk around and people are arrogant. They're insensitive. They don't want to serve. So I'd want to be in something where service would move me ahead.
What advice would you give a small business going after a larger client?
And I developed a simple philosophy. I said that I would call companies and they all wanted to refer me to the contributions department. And I say, no, I don't want a contribution. I want to give you something in return for your giving me something. I would always say that if the president of the smallest country in the world came to America, our president, as a matter of public policy and protocol, would see that president. And I said to the people, I am the president of a very small company, but I am the president. And I feel that as a matter of courtesy, your president ought to see me. Now, I have to say I was never turned down. I was put aside, I was delayed, but I was never turned down. And persistence went out. I think what you need more than anything else in going into business is persistence, a refusal to give up, a motivation to continue when everything looks like you ought to quit. And I think that's what entrepreneurs have to have.
How important is access to information to the small business person?
There's a great need for information, there are all kinds of people out there who are writing me letters and calling up with good ideas and wanting to know how to go into business. So I think if we had a national television show devoted to business development, it would be a great thing.
As the world's finest horses gallop and play in nearby bluegrass pastures, Kentuckians are harnessing a different kind of horsepower. At Toyota Motor Manufacturing Kentucky, Kentuckians are combining the time-tested principles of one of the world's leading automakers with hands-on skill and dedication to build a high standard for quality in American-made vehicles. Each day, Toyota's Kentucky team members put into action the Toyota Production System, known across the world for its quality, safety, and efficiency. TMNK covers about 7.5 million square feet of space, with the equivalent of about 156 football fields under roof. This is one of the most complete vehicle manufacturing plants in the world. TMMK's production process starts in die manufacturing by using everything from computer-controlled laser technology to hand grinding tools. These team members bring the designer's plans to life with quality measured within 0.02 millimeter. Once complete, the dies come to stamping, a shop that covers about 700,000 square feet. The dies will be loaded into one of more than 30 presses in the shop to do their jobs. It takes about 20 hours to complete one of our vehicles. Once stamping begins to make the nearly 300 sheet metal parts needed for each vehicle. Stamping's work begins with these giant coils of steel weighing up to 24 tons. Team members on the floor move the coils using a remote control overhead crane. The coil is loaded into one of our four blanking machines, which straighten and clean the metal. Then the machines cut the metal into blanks. The blanking machines cut the steel at a rate of 80 strokes per minute, using a force of nearly 800 tons. The finished blanks are fed into stackers that automatically stop at the beginning and end of each production process for a quality check. This is one of the many times we will check the quality of our vehicles during the production process. Every team member at Team MK is an inspector. While doing their jobs, they inspect the product to make sure that no defects are passed on to their customer. At Toyota, the customer is not only the person who buys the finished vehicle, but also the next team member in the production process. When blanks pass inspection, they're moved to storage by a forklift operator. They stay there until they're needed on the stamping lines. Then the driver will deliver the blanks to the press. In stamping, Team MK uses more than 20 automated press lines and more than 30 presses, loaded with some 900 dies. Weighing as much as 40 tons each, these dies come together with up to 2,600 tons of pressure to bend, shape, and trim the blanks into formed vehicle parts. To withstand an impact so strong, the floor beneath the presses is nearly 3 feet of solid concrete. The larger presses also rest on several concrete pillars that go as deep as 30 feet below the shop floor. In this basement, metal scraps trimmed from the parts during stamping fall onto a conveyor and are collected for recycling. Throughout our plant, we recycle and reuse as much material as possible in order to be a good steward of the environment. When a different part is needed, die changes are required. For many plants, this is a time-consuming process, but at Team MK, we have the process down to about 10 minutes. At the end of our stamping lines, team members inspect the parts as they come off the presses. Once approved, the parts are stored for a short time until they're needed by our body weld department. In about 2 hours, body weld builds a complete body shell. This shop covers about 1 million square feet. and is the most automated part of our plant. Its team members work with some 700 robots. Body Weld is divided into four lines: underbody respot, underbody tacking, main framing body, and body shell. Here in the underbody respot line, three major sections of the underbody come together: the engine compartment, the front floor, and the rear floor. Then the underbody will move to the main framing body line, where it will join to the quarter panels, the roof, the cowl, and the upper back of the vehicle. Alongside team members, more than 70 computer-controlled robots perform the thousands of precision welds required on this line. Next, the vehicle bodies are lifted onto the overhead conveyor and taken to the body shell line, the last line in body weld. On the body shell line, team members attach various parts, including trunk lids, doors, hoods, and fenders. After final inspection and approval, completed body shells travel by conveyor to our paint shop, or they may head to shipping. If they are among the more than 350 replacement parts that our stamping and body weld shops supply to dealers and other customers around the world, these shops produce repair parts for our vehicles for at least 10 years after Team MK stops production of a model. Here in paint, a body shell gets what will be one of the vehicle's most defining qualities, its color. And we guard the quality of that paint job very closely. Throughout paint, care is taken to keep debris out, because even one speck of dust can ruin a paint finish. As team members enter the shop, they don special lint-free clothing and walk through an air blow room. The air removes any loose hair, thread, or material that may diminish the quality of our paint jobs. These team members working in paint also must be mindful of how personal products might affect the paint process. Our paint process takes about 10 and a half hours to complete, starting when a completed body shell is pulled from body weld. The pull system is an aspect of the Toyota Production System's just-in-time concept. When material or a component, like a body shell, is needed, it's pulled to the shop, not pushed, as in many traditional manufacturing facilities. By pulling instead of pushing, we produce only what we need, when we need it, and in the amount needed. Painting at Toyota involves 8 basic processes, but first the body shell must be cleaned. A series of dips into tanks removes dirt, grease, and other contaminants from the surface. Then the painting begins with a dip into the phosphate tank, a process that etches the body shell so primer and top coat will better adhere to it. Next is the ED dip. Electrodeposition is an electronically charged primer that permanently bonds to the shell. After ED, the body goes through a series of rinses, then is oven baked at nearly 500 degrees. Next, in dry sand and sealing, team members smooth rough spots on the body surface. Then robots apply a seam sealer to prevent corrosion and water leaks. The fourth process in paint is anti-chip. Here, a coating is applied to the bottom of our vehicles where they will receive the most road damage. In the next process, primer is applied to smooth out the appearance of previous layers. Then the body shell is baked again, this time at more than 250 degrees. The sixth process in paint is wet sand. Here the shell will get its final preparation before painting, with team members inspecting it and removing any last imperfections. Next, the vehicle gets its top coat in one of 3 paint booths. This area is another example of Toyota's commitment to the environment. Our paint robots use a unique cartridge and water-based system that lets them quickly switch between paint colors with little waste of paint or the use of harsh chemicals. The robots also are programmed to paint along the contour of the vehicle. This reduces the amount of overspray that enters our reclamation system. Next, the painted shell is baked again, this time at around 250 degrees for about a half an hour. Then the painted body is checked for any imperfections at the eighth and final process, final inspection. There, approved vehicles go to the selectivity bank, ready to be pulled to assembly when needed. While the body shell is being welded and painted, our powertrain shop is building the vehicle's engine. TMMK produces more than 2,000 engines a day on site. We build both 4- and 6-cylinder engines in this 1.2 million square foot shop. Powertrain's raw materials include engine blocks and heads that come from our suppliers. TMMK has more than 350 suppliers in North America, over 100 of which are located in Kentucky. Powertrain machines its camshafts, crankshafts, connecting rods, cylinder blocks, cylinder heads, cam housing, and piston pins from our suppliers' rough castings. The machine components are sent to short block subassembly first. Here, team members install the crankshaft, pistons, and piston pin assemblies. After the engine receives a balance shaft for vibration reduction, it moves to lower assembly, the second assembly process. Next, a team member positions the oil pan just before a machine inserts and tightens the oil pan bolts. If the machine detects any problems, it will stop and send a signal to alert the team leader. This is another key part of the Toyota production system. Jidoka is our practice of stopping production whenever a problem is detected. Many of our machines will automatically do this, and our team members can do this as well to keep any flaws out of our products. Next, a team member installs the timing belt, timing cover, and oil and water pumps. As the engine moves down its line, team members confirm their work and that of previous processes. In the final production stage, the engine gets its cylinder head, wire harness, intake, and exhaust systems. Once completed, the quality of our engines is confirmed in a test cell. Here, the engines are subjected to several tests as team members evaluate them for noise, emissions, and any abnormalities. Approved engines are sent to a shipping room, which holds a 2 to 3 hour supply of engines. Team members of our conveyance team will come to collect the engines that are needed when they are needed by assembly. They'll be delivered just in time. Our assembly plants also get parts from our on-site plastic shop. In this 517,000 square foot shop, team members produce components for our vehicles, including interior trim, rocker panels, manifolds, front and rear bumpers, and instrument panels. Making the instrument panel, or IP, starts in the injection molding area, where plastic pellets are melted and then injected into a mold under several hundred tons of pressure at more than 400 degrees to form the instrument panel's skeleton, which we call a substrate. Nearby, in the slush molding area, molds are filled with a very fine powder and are heated and cooled over several processes to create the skin of the instrument panel. In plastics, IP assembly team members combine the skin and substrate and add padding made of recycled materials, as well as other parts from within the shop and from vendors. Also in the shop's injection molding area, team members make trim for the vehicle's interior and produce the manifold. They injection mold each piece, then combine them using an ultrasonic welder. Robots load the parts into the machine, which uses high-frequency sounds to weld them together. Then the manifolds pass to the manifold assembly line, where they are fitted with gaskets and parts to ready them for vehicle installation. This shop also makes vehicle bumpers. After they are formed by injection molding, the raw bumpers are primed and painted in plastics in much the same way as the vehicle body is painted in our paint department. Rocker panels are also created and painted in this shop using the same process. While plastic supplies assembly with these two parts, the shop also ships them to our sister Camry plant in Indiana and to dealers as service parts. TMMK Plastics ships about 1,000 service parts each day. We supply service parts for up to 21 years after the production stops for a model. The machines and plastics are kept running by the shop's maintenance team members, while another set of skilled tool and die team members repair molds and dies. At the end of each plastics process, team members inspect their parts for quality and then load them onto a parts carrier for delivery to the next process, including assembly. TMMK's assembly shops are the largest in the plant, covering nearly 2 million square feet. Assembly 1, our original plant, builds Avalon and Camry, while Assembly 2 produces Camry and Venza. Each shop is comprised of three operations, or lines: trim, chassis, and final. Assembly's work begins when it pulls a newly painted body shell from paint onto the trim line. Trim installs parts largely unseen by customers, like wiring harnesses, onboard computers, and padding that will keep the vehicle's interior quiet. At the beginning of this line, a team member places a manifest sheet on each vehicle. This sheet tells team members which parts and which options to install on each vehicle coming down the line. Here, the car also gets its set of keys. They will travel the length of the line with the vehicle. As parts for each vehicle are needed, they are delivered lineside by our conveyance team members. Parts arrive from our suppliers constantly throughout the day, orchestrated by our production control department. Using our just-in-time system to minimize inventories and floor space, the plant typically stocks on-site only the parts needed for about 3 hours of production. As parts arrive, some go directly to the line, like seats, which are already in perfect order to match the vehicle in which they're going to be installed. Most parts, however, are brought here to our dock area, where team members sort and prepare them for the line. They'll box some parts for a particular vehicle together into what we call kitting. Kitting involves parts that are small or difficult to differentiate between models. That kit will be delivered to the assembly line and often travels with the vehicle once it's picked. Kitting lets team members focus on a quality installation. As the vehicle works its way down our assembly trim line, it gets one of its most important features, its VIN, or Vehicle Identification Number. This machine is striking a series of numbers and letters onto a metal plate. This VIN is installed at the base of each windshield to permanently identify the vehicle. Here, a team member installs the side curtain airbag, one of the first of up to 10 airbags that will be installed depending on the vehicle model. One of the first Japanese words and concepts that our team members learn at Toyota is Kaizen. It means continuous improvement and is a hallmark of the Toyota production system. Every team member contributes to Kaizen. Here is a great example of Kaizen. When TMMK began production in 1988, the doors stayed on the vehicles throughout the assembly process. Several years later, following a team member's suggestion, we implemented a Kaizen and removed the doors. Now, team members don't waste motion and time walking around the doors or constantly opening and closing them, nor do they chance being hurt by walking into the doors. The Kaizen also reduces the possibility that the doors themselves will be damaged. And it lets us move parts racks closer to the line, again reducing the team member's motion and time. This Kaizen, developed by a team member, helped improve safety, ergonomics, quality, and productivity all in one. Once taken off the vehicle, the doors travel by overhead conveyor to a trim sub-assembly line called the door line. Here, windows, padding, locks, speakers, and other components and options are installed. With the doors now at eye level, team members can complete their work easier and safer. The doors then head into an overhead conveyor system until it's time to reinstall them to the vehicle on the final line. Meanwhile, the doorless vehicle continues its assembly process on the trim line, where the hood insulation is installed. This padding helps keep engine noise in the passenger compartment and outside of the vehicle to an absolute minimum. TMMK builds hybrid versions of many of its models, and here the main hybrid battery is installed. Weighing more than 50 pounds, the battery is placed in the vehicle's trunk with the help of an assistant. Devices like this are used throughout our plant to help keep our team members safe and injury-free. Trim also installs the headliner, moonroof trim, and visors. Hanging just above the line, near our team members, is an andon cord. Our team members have a certain set amount of time to do their jobs. We call this tack time. If they have a concern or encounter a problem that keeps them from meeting that tack time, they can pull the andon cord and call for help. Pulling the andon cord activates tunes, lights, and boards that tell team and group leaders that they're needed and where. They'll respond and try to address the concern without stopping the line, but if they can't do that within the tech time, they will pull the cord again and all of production stops. Or, if need be, they'll take the vehicle offline to make any needed repairs. Next, in trim, the vehicle gets the instrument panel that was made for it in plastics. When the IP left plastics, it came to the IP line, another sub-assembly line here in trim. Here, team members install, among other components, air conditioning ductwork, controls, gauges to monitor speed and fuel, stereo options, and the steering column. Once the IP is complete, an automatic guided vehicle, or AGV, delivers it lineside for installation into the vehicle. These smart carts are made by team members and follow a magnetic strip in the floor to their destination. Team members use a hoist to install the IP into the vehicle. Team members also use a hoist to install the rear struts, which can weigh about 70 pounds each. These devices greatly reduce the ergonomic burden on our team members and help ensure a quality installation. Trim also installs the vehicle's axles, parts which...
One in a Million, the history of Madam C.J. Walker and her entrepreneurial legacy. Not even her poor and difficult beginnings stymied Madam Walker's road to greatness. Born December 23, 1867, roughly 2 years after the alleged emancipation of her race, she was an orphan at 7, a wife at 14, a mother at 17, and a widow by 20. The woman who would become known as the first self-made female millionaire and the greatest benefactress of her race was born the daughter of Owen and Minerva Breedlove, poor ex-slaves living on a cotton farm in Louisiana. They named their special little girl Sarah Breedlove. A washerwoman by trade, at the age of 33 in 1900, Sarah began selling a product door to door which she had formulated to remedy her own hair loss. She pinpointed the root of her hair problems, which was the scalp, and created hair care products and a beauty regimen for hair growth and maintenance that focused on the need for a clean and healthy scalp, scalp protection, and scalp stimulation for maximum hair growth. Her first product would eventually be called Madam C.J. Walker's Wonderful Hair Grower, and she boldly and proudly used her own likeness on her jars and her own before and after pictures to demonstrate her product's effectiveness. Per Madam's own words, she abhorred the impression held by some that she claimed to straighten hair. She emphatically stated, "I grow hair," and that there would be no hair-growing business today had I not started it. She described her concept and method of hair growth as beauty culture because she compared growing hair to growing and cultivating garden plants. She then broadened this concept of beauty culture by incorporating the value of cleanliness and professionalism, which emphasized the overall appearance, moral conduct, and character of the black woman. Black women from all over the country began writing letters to Madam Walker, attesting to the benefits of her products. By setting up a special correspondence course of beauty culture in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and then a manufacturing facility in Indiana, and later a beauty college in New York City, Madam was able to further establish and promulgate her program of beauty culture, which trained the black female in three areas. First, the black woman was taught the proper presentation of herself. She was to be clean, neat, properly attired, and well-mannered. Second, she was taught how to use Madam's hair care system on customers. And third, she was taught how to sell Madam's hair care products to customers. In so doing, Madam C.J. Walker provided a solution to the root of the black woman's demise. She raised the black woman's self-esteem and confidence about her own beauty and intelligence, and she empowered the black woman economically, thus freeing her from white servitude and male dependency. This accomplishment is even more amazing when put in the context of the time in which these things were done and in the context of Madam's own background. The time, one historian called the nadir, or lowest point in the history of the black race, outside of slavery itself. The blessings of freedom was now marred by the blatant terrorist acts of the Ku Klux Klan and those like-minded individuals working in collusion with them. The harsh reality faced by the vast majority of blacks living in this era was that the number of lynchings peaked during the early 1900s, as did other backlashes sparked by Reconstruction, such as the burning of black churches and schools and the establishment of Jim Crow laws. During this dark period, most black women were either sharecroppers or washerwomen and house servants for whites. Madam Walker was no exception, but she was, however, exceptional. Madam Walker moved her ever-expanding special correspondence course business, founded on her system of beauty culture, to Indianapolis, Indiana, on February 19, 1910. She then purchased and paid for her home, adjoining which was a factory and laboratory, located at 640 North West Street. She endeared herself to the citizens of Indianapolis when she contributed $1,000 to the establishment of the Senate Avenue YMCA. It is reported that she was the only woman to make such a donation. Madam herself, when referring to the YMCA donation, had this to say, quote, "In referring to that $1,000 gift, I don't want you to lay so much stress on it, and do not say that I am the only one. You might say that I was the first and caused others to awaken to the sense of their duty in helping deserving causes for the benefit of the race," end quote. Not long after her move to Indianapolis, Madam Walker also became a member of Bethel AME Church, one of the oldest and most influential churches in the black community, to which Madam Walker contributed generously. In less than 2 years after moving to Indianapolis, on September 2, 1911, Madam C.J. Walker petitioned the Indiana Secretary of State to become incorporated, and on September 19, 1911, exactly 1 year and 7 months since her arrival in Indianapolis, the Madam C.J. Walker Manufacturing Company of Indiana Incorporated was established, Madam Walker naming herself president and owner of all 1,000 shares of stock. A relentless worker and ingenious marketer and saleswoman, Madam Walker had thought to place her system of hair care products in black colleges all across the United States. She also regularly advertised in black newspapers, and she eventually placed her products in drugstores. As she traveled throughout the country, she wrote letters to her general manager in order to instruct him on how best to run her factory in her absence and how to implement all of her new ideas. However, the Madam Walker agents, Madam's recruited sales force, were her biggest asset. Madam held public meetings in churches, rented lodge halls and other such facilities, and put on demonstrations, including a slide presentation, in order to recruit black women to become Walker agents. Madam Walker taught and trained them in the methods of application and proper use of her hair oils and vegetable shampoo. Eventually, Madam organized a national convention for her Walker agents, giving away prizes and other incentives to motivate and energize her ever-growing troops of Walker agents. Sales generated from Madam Walker's manufacturing company and the hair care products it produced enabled Madam to give birth to yet another legacy, as Madam became known as the greatest benefactress of her race. Through monies earned and derived from Madam's work in the hair-growing business, Madam Walker regularly donated large sums of money to charity and to individuals of her race who were in need. In fact, Madam was so self-sacrificing and freely giving that those closest to her were worried that she would become financially ruined. Desiring all blacks to have decent homes, at times, Madam would assume mortgages of blacks who were financially strapped, allowing them to repay when and how they could. Various schools for blacks and certain social and civic organizations dedicated to the betterment of the black race were also beneficiaries of Madam's philanthropy. Though many have called Madam extravagant, her generosity and passion for her people were Madam's only extravagances. She gave not for self-aggrandizement, but rather to inspire other wealthy blacks to give likewise. Moreover, Madam's giving went well beyond monetary donations. She lent her name and time to worthy causes. She traversed the country, speaking against lynchings, and fought vehemently for the fair treatment of black soldiers who had served in America's military during World War I. Madam C.J. Walker was an ambassador of sorts, a spokesperson for all black-skinned people, a revolutionary, visionary, missionary force. It should therefore be quite obvious that Madam Walker's passing on May 25, 1919, was a tremendous loss to the black race. At that time, Madam had recruited over 25,000 black women from the United States, Central America, and the Caribbean as door-to-door beauty culturists and was well on her way to Africa. Her net worth was over $1 million, making her the first female, regardless of color, to become a self-made millionaire. She is one of the most successful black entrepreneurs of all time and one of the first to utilize the method known today as direct sales marketing to distribute her products. She had also managed to build a 32-room mansion in Irvington, New York called Villa Loaro, which she had desired to be left as a monument to her name and as an example to her race of what hard work and black support of black enterprises could achieve. After Madam's 1919 passing, her hair care manufacturing corporation was used as collateral to secure the finances needed to build what is today known as the Madam Walker Theater Building. Completed in late 1927, the Walker Building Beauty Salon continues to operate there and continues to sell Madam C.J. Walker's original hair care products. Years later, in 1982, the trustees of Madam Walker's trust would deposit a large portion of Madam C.J. Walker Manufacturing Company's business records, historical documents, pictures, and memorabilia with the Indiana Historical Society, who took on the task of painstakingly organizing and preserving the Madam Walker legacy. 74 years after the incorporation of the Madam Walker Company in 1985, the 1,000 shares of capital stock of Madam's corporation were sold to a man named Raymond L. Randolph, making him the first person since Madam Walker herself to own all 1,000 shares of stock in the original Madam Walker Company. A graduate of Attucks High School, Mr. Randolph had never dreamed that he would become the owner and caretaker of this phenomenal legacy. In honor of Madam C.J. Walker, Mr. Randolph placed Madam Walker's image back on the jars of her original hair care products with the words, "Since 1911, placed underneath it. Doing business today as Madam C.J. Walker Enterprises Incorporated, the hair care company founded by Madam C.J. Walker continues to manufacture and sell her original quality products, ensuring that the legacy of this remarkable woman never dies. The Madam Walker Agent Program has been reinstituted and is the main method by which her products are distributed today. On September 24, 2011, Madam C.J. Walker Enterprises sponsored a centennial celebratory walk called Tracing the Footsteps of a Legacy. This event marked the 100th year since the pivotal point in her entrepreneurial legacy when Madam Walker incorporated her manufacturing company, the Madam C.J. Walker business family, which includes the Madam Walker agents, will continue to keep Madam Walker's spirit alive and well by ensuring that her labor of love, her manufacturing business, continues operating according to the entrepreneurial blueprint she left behind and which is detailed in the historical documents of the company. Thank you. Thank you, Sarah Breedlove. You are indeed one in a million.